Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is human morality the product of nurture or nature? Parents spend years trying to instill their values in their children, and many religious traditions see morality as both a gift and a command from God. But as my guest today has discovered, families and churches might be getting more of a hand from biology than they realize. In fact, there is evidence that the building blocks for ethical behavior, including empathy, compassion, even a basic instinct for fairness and cooperation, might be built into the brains of many social animals, including human beings. Franz de Waal is C.H. Candler Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University and Director of the Living Link Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. His new book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Franz, welcome to Think.
Well, I'm glad to be there.
So why do we tend to believe that we are naturally inclined to be nasty and brutish unless socialized to behave otherwise?
Well, I think that's a misunderstanding. We certainly have some nasty tendencies. I would agree with that, and that's true for many animals, obviously. But we are inherently social animals, and so we're adapted to live in groups. We were very unhappy. Actually, one of the worst punishments we can give people is isolation, and so we're very unhappy when we're not social, and so I think we are inherently social animals.
And if we hadn't been social animals and found ways to live together naturally, we wouldn't have gotten this far. Is that true?
Yeah, we survive by cooperation, and this is true for many animals. There's many animals who, like in the primates, I work with primates, we know that if they are alone, which sometimes happens, their survival is in danger. And so they are really group animals, and we survive in groups. And so we're very dependent on that, and that also makes that we care about others, because if you survive because you're surrounded by others, you need to care about them to some degree at least. And so that's where our caring tendencies come from.
So it has finally faded from popularity, but for a long time the theory was that our righteous behavior, the things we do that are sort of right and moral, was just a thin veneer over our selfish desires.
Yeah, and that's actually many biologists have promoted that view also in the last decades. Of course, in the last few years, everything has changed because the neuroscientists have found that we actually take pleasure in giving to others, and the economists have found that we have an inherent sense of fairness all over the world and so on. And primatologists such as myself, we explain that primates are extremely social animals that don't have only nasty tendencies.
So, Franz, what can we learn about human instincts and behavior by studying other primates, and what are the limitations of those comparisons?
Well, I think by saying that many of the tendencies that are in our moral systems are older than our species, you're going to get a debate about what the role is of our culture and religion, because sometimes it is assumed that our morality comes from God or comes from religion. Well, our current religions are just 2,000 or 3,000 years old. That's extremely young in the eyes of a biologist. And so I believe that our moral tendencies are much older, maybe 500,000 year old or older, and are connected to our primate heritage. And so by studying other primates, what you're basically saying is that many of the things that we think we developed very recently may be far older than we think.
But on the other hand, despite a number of sort of decent behaviors displayed in lab settings and in the wild by chimpanzees, you stop short of calling them moral creatures. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think human morality is special in that we care about the community as a whole. So I see in other primates and in other animals, including in dogs, for example, I see a lot of concern about relationships. My relationship with you, and I should not fight, and or if we fight, we should reconcile. And actually, primates like chimpanzees, they kiss and embrace after fights, and so they're very worried about their individual relationships. But whether they are worried about their community as a whole, where they think like, are things fairly divided, or who is behaving badly in my community, and so on, the sort of concerns that we have, I'm not sure we see that, and so I feel humans go a step further in some of these concerns than the other primates do, and of course we try to codify them and justify the rules that we make. And so in all these regards, we are special, and if that's what we call morality, then I think we are the only ones to have it.
Why is empathy at the core of most behavior that we consider to be moral or ethical?
Yeah, that is because if you would not have empathy, you would not care about others. It would be totally indifferent to you how other people behave and what happens to them. So empathy allows us to enter the world of others and be concerned about others. And without that capacity, I don't think you will ever get a moral system. So if we were like sharks, for example, where sharks really don't care about each other, they have no bonds, they just float around in the ocean and they look for food. So if we have no bonds and no concern for each other, why would we want to have a moral system? So empathy is at the absolute core of all these capacities. And empathy, we believe now, is a general mammalian feature. And that's why the reason that, for example, many people have dogs and cats at home instead of, let's say, iguanas and turtles is precisely because we like that in mammals. We like the fact that they are sensitive to our emotions and we are sensitive to their emotions. We like that emotional connection that we have.
And it's interesting that you say emotions, because most of us experience empathy as a feeling, but in fact, there is a biochemical basis to our ability to sort of cringe at the pain of another sentient creature.
Yeah, there is a hormone. It's called oxytocin, which is often called a maternal hormone or the cuddle hormone, because it helps with nursing, it helps with the delivery of babies and so on. And so it's very much a maternal hormone. And we think actually that empathy started with maternal care in the mammals. Whether you're a mouse or an elephant, you need to care for your offspring. And if you are not sensitive to their emotions, you may lose your offspring. And so we think maternal care is the origin of a lot of empathic tendencies, and that explains two things. That explains why women have usually more empathy than men, and which is universally true for our species and has been found now in other mammals as well. And why oxytocin, if you spray that in the nostrils of humans, both men and women, they will become more empathic. And so oxytocin is a hormone that has an influence on it.
So how has living in societies, whether human societies or animal societies, shaped the development of empathy in different animals?
Oh, I think some animals, of course, they live in larger connections than others. So if you're a solitary animal, like let's say a tiger, you need empathy for your offspring. At least the female needs it. But otherwise, maybe not at all. Whereas if you live in a larger scale society, like let's say most of the primates or dolphins or elephants or humans for that matter, in that case you need to extend that empathy to not just your offspring, but you need to have it for your friends and your collaborators and other connections that you have. And so I think we humans are a highly social species. We are very much dependent on these large-scale societies. And so we have a very wide-ranging empathy that even sometimes includes other species. And so we can empathize, for example, with a stranded whale, which is really not what empathy was intended for by nature, I think, but we can do those things.
Well, okay, so many people are following here and say, well, that's true, but if you're living in a society, maybe empathy is a learned behavior of some kind. Can you talk about what we can learn about the foundations of instinctively empathetic behavior by studying, say, very young children?
Yeah, so empathy is basically an automated response. And so we have actually not so much control over it. We study it, for example, in our chimpanzees, by looking at how yawning is contagious. So, for example, people who are very empathic, they are also very sensitive to the yawning of others. And so they start to yawn as soon as somebody else is yawning. We study that in our chimpanzees. We present them with videos of yawning chimpanzees, and we see they start yawning also. And we can measure sort of the differences in empathy levels. And so there are many of these automated responses. For example, young children, they already at a very young age, one of the first experiments on empathy was you ask a family member to cry, and then you see how young children respond. And even when they can barely walk, they're less than 2 years old, they walk up to the person, they touch them, they stroke them, very similar to what my chimpanzees do if someone has lost in a fight, so another chimpanzee has beaten them up, and they're sitting alone, and then there's others who approach, and they kiss them and embrace them and groom them and try to calm them down. And so these are empathic responses that we see appear very early.
What do we know about what's going on in our brains when we make empathetic or emotional calculations and decisions? What kinds of cells get activated?
Well, there's not so much known about it, but the neuroscientists are very active, and one of the key features they think are mirror neurons. So these are neurons who are activated both when you see somebody else do something in the same way as when you do yourself the same thing. So these are neurons that basically don't distinguish clearly between your own actions and somebody else's actions. And they think they are involved in all sorts of imitation and empathy. And so there is a field of neuroscience now increasingly working on empathy. And so, for example, if you, let's say you stick a needle in the arm of a man, and his wife is in the scanner, and so sees that happening, and she's in the brain scanner, then there are parts of her brain that are activated as if she's feeling the pain herself. Mm-hmm. So she has a pain response in her brain to a needle that is stuck into the arm of somebody else. So that kind of science is now being done, and we think in many primates they have very similar sort of reactions. Mm-hmm.
What are the limits to empathy, and what accounts for those? Because clearly there are times when animals, you know, are over it, and humans are over it, and we can in fact do things that are pretty cruel to others, even within our own communities.
Well, yeah, empathy is very biased. So it's empathy. For example, these yawn contagion studies that people do on humans also. We yawn especially if individuals close to us or similar to us yawn. This has been actually studied in humans, and we have found the same thing in chimpanzees. And so empathy is biased in the sense that we have a lot more of it for our family members and our friends than for strangers, and especially strangers who are unlike us. We have very little empathy, and so that's the flip side of empathy, is that that's the xenophobia that we have towards strangers. So empathy is very constrained. And then in addition, even though I say it's automatically activated, that doesn't necessarily mean it's translated into positive behavior, because once empathy is activated, that doesn't mean that I'm going to act upon it immediately. And so if I walk in the street and I see a beggar and I have some sympathy for the beggar, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to give money or stop for him. I may actually cross the street and avoid the beggar. Hmm. And so we take all sorts of intelligent or cognitive decisions that override our empathy responses, and so that's constantly going on.
And I guess that's also where culture plays a role.
Yeah, because culture can either emphasize empathy and say we need to really care about these people or those people, but of course culture can also tell us to not care about certain people and instruct us not to do that.
Are animals, I mean, do they practice nepotism? Do they care more about, say, a cousin animal than they would care about one that is not related to them if they're part of the same group?
Oh, yeah. No, animals, especially the primates, they're very kin-oriented. Mm-hmm. And so your sister is worth a lot more than some other female, that's for sure. And so that's true in all the primates. They're very kin-biased.
My guest is Franz de Waal. He is C.H. Candler, Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University and author of the new book, The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. We've got phone lines open now if you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biologist Franz de Waal. He is C.H. Candler Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University and directs the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. His new book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. How important is predation among particular species in cultivating a higher than average level of cooperation and team behavior and morality and empathy?
Well, predation is the reason that primates live in groups. So if you're small primates, like let's say small monkeys, they have to be careful with birds of prey, and they warn each other for those or for snakes sometimes. Chimpanzees, who are of course much larger, they deal with leopards. They actually protect each other against leopards, which is a very risky affair. So they hear the screaming of a chimpanzee who is attacked in the forest. They don't always see each other, but they hear it. And then they rush over and they will try to liberate that individual from the leopard, which is a very risky affair. And so the primates, I don't think they would be living in groups if it wasn't for that kind of pressures that they face. And so even the largest primates have that problem, but the small ones definitely do.
What do we know about how much primates understand about the nature of death?
Of what?
Of death.
Death. We think that they know that if someone else dies, one of their companions dies, that that's a permanent change. They're extremely affected by it. They sometimes don't eat for days. They're completely silent. They stare at the body. They sometimes try to reanimate the body. So they're very affected. And so we think they understand that it's a permanent change in condition, which is not good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they know anything about their own death, like we do, your own mortality, and for some people this is actually an explanation of why we have religions, is that we have a sense of mortality. Whether they have that, we don't know. And it's not something we can ask them. We don't have obvious indicators that they do. But it's a possibility, but I've never seen any proof of it.
You know, what's really interesting is that it would seem to be reasonable that, particularly for other kinds of animals besides humans, that if a member of the troop or tribe was, mentally deficient or physically weak, that it would be better off for the group to just leave that individual behind. But you've had some amazing examples of sort of special exceptions made for animals that their companions recognize are just don't have the same faculties as the rest of the group.
Yeah, so I firsthand I know of a young rhesus monkey who was trisomic, so that's the same condition as human Down syndrome. So it was a trisomic rhesus monkey who had clearly problems socially adjusting. She followed all the wrong rules. She would, for example, threaten the alpha male, which is certainly not something that a young monkey should be doing. And what I found remarkable is that she got so little punished for it. Her name was Azalea. So it was extremely rare that anyone would pay much attention to this, and she was very popular. Many individuals tried to cuddle with her and hold her or drag her around. And so I found it remarkable in a rhesus monkey society, which is really a harsh, pretty despotic society, that this monkey was so well accepted. And the other examples of individuals who had trouble, who are either limping or have trouble walking, that others tried to slow down to have them follow them and so on. And so, yes, primates are not necessarily cutthroat the way people think they are. Sometimes they are, and especially between males when they're competing over dominance, they can be very harsh and very mean and aggressive. But much of the time, they're actually quite cooperative.
And then sometimes after a fight, they encourage one another to sort of, as you alluded to earlier, kiss and make up.
Yeah, so that's usually a task for high-ranking females who then are faced with some males who have been in a fight and they're not making up afterwards. And these males, they easily can return to their violent behavior, of course. Usually it's some of the oldest females who then walk up to one of these males and start grooming them and try to calm them down. And then drag them, literally sometimes, take them by the arm and move them towards the other male, to make sure that the two of them end up grooming each other. Hmm. And so I'm very interested in that kind of behavior, because if you talk about human morality, we are concerned about the community. And so I see some of these glimpses in other primates, like in the chimpanzees, where I see glimpses of them being interested in sort of the harmony in the community as a whole.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Karen in Dallas. Hi, Karen.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to ask your guest about motor neurons and how they may relate to empathy, and also how they may be affect autism.
Yeah, so these are called mirror neurons. They are in the motor cortex. And these neurons, they perform, they're activated in the same way when, let's say, you reach for a cup with your hand, or you see somebody else reach for the same cup with his hand. And so that's very strange. These neurons are activated, and they don't distinguish necessarily between your action or somebody else's action. And that's why the neuroscientists say these neurons, that's why they're called mirror neurons, they really fuse your body with somebody else's body. They don't draw a line between you and somebody else. And so they allow us to become one with somebody else, which is, of course, the origin of empathy. And that's why they're considered extremely important. It's a discovery of only 10 or 15 years ago. Hmm. And so that's the mirror neurons. And there is some speculation that in autism, and that's called the broken mirror hypothesis, is that in autism there's something wrong or something missing in these mirror neurons. But that's a very controversial hypothesis. And so at the moment, I think there's supporters for it, but there's also many people who criticize the hypothesis. And so I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not convinced that that's necessarily the case, is that autism is due to a deficiency in the mirror neurons.
So perhaps a step up from empathy is something like fairness, where we want fairness not only for ourselves, but for other people. And you described some really clever experiments with capuchin monkeys who are rewarded for tasks with either a cucumber slice, which is like a decent reward, or a grape, which is this major treat. Can you talk about that research?
Yeah, anyone who's in front of a computer can type in the word monkey and fairness, and we'll end up with the video that now has gone viral, which has been seen maybe by 4 million people, on monkeys reacting to unfairness. And so what we do in that particular experiment is we take two capuchin monkeys who normally know each other. We put them in a test chamber, and we start rewarding them for the same task, a very simple task. They need to pick up a rock and put it in our hand. If you give both monkeys slices of cucumber, they will do it 25 times in a row. If you give both monkeys grapes, which is much better food, they will also do it 25 times in a row. But if you give one monkey grapes and the other monkey cucumber, so you're creating inequality there, then the one who gets cucumber, and after a few times, starts to protest.
Like, I want a grape.
Yeah, well, they throw the food away, which is an irrational response, because food is always better than no food.
Uh-huh.
So they throw the cucumbers away, they refuse to perform the task, they become very agitated, they become basically angry at the unfairness of the whole thing. And so we've done a lot of these experiments now also with chimpanzees, and chimpanzees actually go much further than this, than the monkeys, and have more a sense of fairness that is more similar to the human one. So we've done many of these experiments, and they basically indicate that primates compare. They see what they get, and they see what somebody else gets, and they compare. And if it doesn't compare very well in their opinion, they're going to express that opinion.
And there are times when primates will actually say, well, if my buddy's not getting a grape, I don't want a grape either?
Yeah, that's in chimpanzees we see that, not in the capuchin monkeys. The capuchin monkeys are like, in that sense, like young children who only care about getting less than somebody else.
Right.
They're very upset about that, but they don't particularly are upset when they get more than somebody else. But the chimpanzees, yes, the chimpanzees also protest if they get a better deal, and then they wait till the other one also gets a deal like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Birdie in Denton. Hi, Birdie.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Fond about how he talked about bees and ants being social insects, that they will sacrifice themselves for the betterment of the group.
I'm not sure if you were able to, it's kind of a bad connection, Fran. She was talking about bees and ants being willing to sacrifice themselves for the good of the hive or the colony.
Yeah, so in the social insects, we see high levels of cooperation like this. They actually, they also put the community very high on their list, so to speak. But the mechanism is probably totally different. So in mammals, we think that empathy is involved, why, for example, a dog will lick your face if you're crying. Actually, these experiments have been done with mammals. And so mammals have an empathic reaction to distress. But whether in the social insects it has anything to do with empathy, we really doubt that. And so it's a totally different way that they achieve the same goals. But they're very cooperative animals.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have a question here from Susan who says, do you suppose if a sociopath were given oxytocin that they might be capable of empathy?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that that's the case. The sociopaths are interesting because they really lack empathy. And so they have the cognitive capacities to take your perspective. So sometimes people say empathy is that you put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. Well, the sociopaths are intelligent enough to do that, but they have no feelings about it, it seems. Like there's no emotions associated with it. And so they can equally well put themselves in your shoes to get something from you or to steal money from you or to take your life in the most extreme case. And so I don't know what happens with a sociopath if you give them oxytocin. I'm not sure they have the substrate in their brain to work with that, but I don't know the answer to this.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Shelley in Dallas. Hi, Shelley.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a few different questions for your guest. We have all seen these viral videos on the internet of maybe a dog gets hit by a car and then a companion dog races across the highway to rescue his friend. And I'm wondering if your guest thinks that this is typical for dogs all the time or it just by chance was caught on video. Are there certain breeds that are more empathetic than others? We oftentimes use St. Bernard, you know, rescuing, or at least the image is that the St. Bernard is going to be rescuing somebody that's caught in the snow. And then my last question is going back to the viral video and the dog rescuing the other. Do you think that if it was a pack of dogs that they would, you know, do the same thing, or would they be more inclined to have a pack mentality and leave the one dog behind?
Yeah, so dogs are highly social, and there's also a video, for example, of one dog who kept waiting after the Japanese tsunami, kept waiting next to a friend who was probably dead at that point. So dogs can be very attached also to humans, of course. There are dogs who sit at the grave of their owner after he has died. So there's very strong attachments, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily breed-related. I think it's more the relationship between the two that matters. And actually, this kind of altruistic behavior of dragging their friend off the highway, that has recently been tested in rats. Now, you would not normally associate rats with this kind of behavior, I'm sure, but there was an experiment done in Chicago where they would lock up a rat in a container, and another rat would then learn over time, and it was not easy to open that container. Another rat would be outside and would try to open that container to liberate the first. And in that experiment, even at some point, they would lock up chocolate in one container and a rat in another container to see which one do they open first. And many rats, especially female rats, and this relates to the higher level of empathy that I talked about in females, they would open the trapped rat first and then open the chocolate one, and then they would have to share the chocolate with the one that they just liberated.
Do we give rats a bad name?
I think rats have a bad name. Rats are mammals, and all the mammals have these basic tendencies, one way or another.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Fort Worth. We have Glenn on the line. Hey, Glenn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's an interesting discussion, but I would like to challenge the guest a little bit, I think, and say, if empathy is the benchmark that we're using to measure morality or the ability for the inclination towards moral behavior, I think it's a weak one. I agree that we have to have it, but I think it's only a starting point. It would be completely possible to go through life feeling very empathetic towards many, many, many different people and situations, and yet at the same time, at the end of the day, make very many immoral decisions. Without religion, without God, without some sort of a basis for searching for God's will in our life, we can feel empathetic, and that feeling can be powerful, but yet we can go through life making completely immoral decisions as a even despite feeling empathetic.
Well, what do you think about that, Franz?
Well, partly I'm in agreement. So I'm in agreement with the fact that empathy is not sufficient. You can have a lot of empathy. Actually, we may have a lot of empathy for a lot of people, but we cannot act upon that all the time. And so we need to take decisions. Which cases do we want to act upon and which cases we don't? Because we would go under if we would react to all of it. And so moral decision-making still is needed, and empathy by itself is not sufficient. So in that part, I'm in agreement. But then, of course, Glenn also says that you need God or religion to make these decisions, and that I'm not convinced of. I'm not sure that that's the only way you can take moral decisions. You can also take moral decisions, for example, by thinking about the consequences or thinking about what is best under these circumstances, and so then you arrive in a very different way at your moral decisions, but it would still be moral.
We're speaking this hour with Franz de Waal, who is C.H. Candler Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes Primate Center. His new book is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. We've got lines open once again if you'd like to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Franz de Waal. He is C.H. Candler Professor of Primate Behavior at Emory University, and he has a new book out called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Franz, if morality seems to be a natural feature of human existence, why have human societies demonstrated such a widespread interest in religion and in fact, a profession that we need religion?
Yeah, so that's a big puzzle, is that the book is partly called The Bonobo and the Atheist because I don't agree with the neo-atheists who have been bashing religion as universally bad.
Mm-hmm.
If all human societies believe in the supernatural and all human societies have some form of religion, it must be doing something for us. That's what I assume as a biologist. And so I think what happened in our large-scale societies is that religion became necessary to fortify morality. So I don't think religion is the source of morality. That's how it is often presented, is that God gave us morality and moral rules like the Ten Commandments. But I think religion came much later. Humans were probably already living in societies that had moral rules and right and wrong and so on. And then when we got these bigger societies where you had 1,000 people or maybe millions of people like we have now, you cannot all keep an eye on each other, and that's why probably religion became important to codify morality, to justify it, to make narratives about it, to explain it to people, to have God who watches over us. And so religion became a necessary component of the big scale societies. And I don't see any of it, any evidence of it in other primates. But they live in much smaller scale societies. So they live in societies of maybe 100 individuals where everyone keeps an eye on everybody.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Miriam in Richardson. Hi, Miriam.
Hi. My question is about, I'm not sure if there's any research on this, but have there been studies done on animals that were raised in captivity? Do they also demonstrate these types of behaviors? Basically, is it something that is developed based on social interaction, or is it something that they're born with that can be developed later on? So that was just basically the question that I had.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, so most of my research is on animals in captivity. I work at the Yerkes Primate Center, where we have an outdoor facility where the chimpanzees live in outdoor areas in Georgia. But I also have students who work in the field, and so we also know a lot about the field work. In general, I would say the psychology of primates is very similar in the field and in captivity. And so, for example, many of these tendencies of helping each other, sharing food with each other, acts of empathy and sympathy, all of these behaviors you can see under both conditions. And then, of course, in captivity, we can do experiments. So we do, for example, experiments with chimpanzees where we see if you give them the opportunity to feed themselves or to feed themselves plus a partner, what do they prefer? And actually, they prefer options where they can feed themselves plus the partner. Hmm. So they actually do care about partners, and you can set up controlled experiments, something that the field workers really cannot do in the forest.
For animals that you're working with that are in captivity, that you're experimenting on, and these are social experiments, you're not, you know, sticking them with mm-hmm. drugs and that sort of thing, but do you have to control at all for the relationships that form between the scientists and the animals they're studying?
No, because most of the tests that we do are between chimpanzees, or they're not between us and them.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the time we take two chimpanzees, let's say, who live in a group together. We call them by name into a building. If they want to come, they come. If they don't want to come, they don't come. So it's all on a voluntary basis. Then they enter the building, and we are only there to set up the experiment and to distribute the things that need to be distributed.
So they're not sort of watching. They don't see you watching them and paying attention.
They may see us watching them, but it is really, we set it up in such a way that the main events happen between the two apes, and we are basically out of that. And we do the same thing with children. We recently did an experiment that is called the ultimatum game with chimpanzees, and then we played exactly the same game with human children, doing everything exactly the same, and we got basically the same results also.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Jeffrey in Dallas. Hi, Jeffrey.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if the guys can please explain from the point of view of, I understand that the relationship between human DNA and chimpanzee DNA is quite close. So from the point of view of DNA, if you can please explain the behavior in chimps with regards to morality.
Yeah, so in terms of DNA, our DNA is 98.5% identical to that of chimpanzees or bonobos. So in that sense, we're extremely similar. We're suspect to the similar diseases. We have a very similar body structure. Our brains are larger, though. Our brains are three times larger than those of a bonobo or a chimpanzee. And so there's nothing in the human brain that is not present, really, in that of, a monkey or a chimpanzee. So our brain is not different. All the structures and the whole operation of the brain is basically similar, but it's three times bigger. And so the thinking is, of course, that if humans are different from the apes, That is largely due to the fact that we have a more powerful computer and can compute more or less, so to speak, than it's not a different computer. It's a more powerful one.
It's funny that we've gotten this far in the hour and not talked more about bonobos, but these are really fascinating animals. And for one thing, they sort of remind us that a very belligerent way of looking at the world and at our enemies is not the only way to go in the primate world.
Yeah, there is this tendency in anthropology especially to look at human history and human evolution as one big battlefield. As we wiped out everybody else, we were victorious, and that's how we became such an important species. And even the Neanderthals, we wiped them out. And that's the thinking in anthropology, a very sort of violent scenario. Now, the chimpanzee seems to fit that scenario pretty well, because chimpanzee males can be very violent between groups, and they kill between groups. But bonobos, you know, we call bonobos sometimes the hippies of the primate world. They're equally close to us as chimps. They're equally relevant. But the females are dominant over the males. They're collectively dominant. They're not bigger than males, but they collectively dominate the males. They have a lot of sex. They have very little aggression and violence. When groups meet, they usually end up having sex and grooming each other rather than fighting with each other. And so the bonobo is a very different animal, and that's why anthropologists really don't like the comparisons with the bonobo, because it doesn't fit their thinking. Hmm. But if you think that we now know that we have 4 to 6% of our DNA comes from the Neanderthals, which means that we have been doing something else with the Neanderthals than just fighting. We have been doing some sex with them. And we don't know how that happened and what happened, but it sounds a lot more like the bonobo solution to things than what is usually thought about a human evolution.
Yeah, and I guess it does really change the way we frame things when we consider that we have also a peaceful and very hypersexual history.
Yeah. And so instead of, I don't deny that humans are aggressive and that we can be very territorial, and in that sense we are similar to chimpanzees, but the assumption that all of our history was filled with that kind of behavior, that's just an assumption. We don't have a lot of evidence for that. Of course, the last few centuries we have seen our share of violence in the world, and that's maybe why we think this way, but it is not sure at all that it has always been this way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ken in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. This is absolutely fascinating. If you discovered a collection of characteristics that used to be sort of attached to human beings, empathy, sympathy, human-like behavior, how has the language to describe such characteristics changed? Because if a lot of the animals in the animal kingdom have the same characteristics, it seems like the language should reflect that. In other words, we should remove the word human and attach some other word to it to describe that collection of characteristics. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I'm a big advocate for animals that are close to us, like chimpanzees and bonobos, to use the same language as we use for ourselves. I don't see a reason. If, let's say, two chimpanzees kiss and embrace each other after a fight between them, and you call that reconciliation, sometimes people object and they say, well, we should call it something else because these are chimpanzees. And I feel that they're so close to us that probably the psychology behind that behavior is very similar, and so we should use a similar terminology instead of giving animals different labels for everything than what humans do.
So what does make us human?
Well, that's a very good question. I think socially and emotionally, we are very similar to the great apes, and I don't see an enormous amount of difference. I do think that technologically we are quite different, and you can see that in the sort of things that we invent that chimpanzees never invent. And I think also our language makes us different, and language is of course a means of communication, and of course all animals have ways of communicating with each other, but language is really special because it's a symbolic communication. And that's not something that we find in many animals, no animals, I would say. And so language makes us unique. And then language, of course, affects everything we do and the way we classify the world, the way we organize things around us. So language is not a small characteristic, it's a big characteristic.
It is really astonishing the things that we have learned in recent decades about how much more sophisticated not just other primates, but many kinds of animals are than we ever imagined in the past.
Yeah, that's a big trend of the moment, is that, of course, many of these things start with a study on, let's say, chimpanzees, showing that chimpanzees are very similar to human capacities in maybe mathematics or technology and so on. But then very soon, people working with elephants or with crows or with octopuses or you name it, very soon there's then going to be other species that come into the picture, and they may not do exactly the same as humans and chimps, but they get very close. And so the trend over the last 10 years, 15 years has been that things that we thought were uniquely human turn up in other species. And so that makes other species far more sophisticated than we usually thought they were.
Has this shifted over the course of your career, the way you feel about animal rights and the responsibility that humans have to care for animals?
Yeah, I think all of these discoveries, they add to the picture that animals deserve a lot of attention. And instead of looking at animals as unfeeling and unthinking, which is what we used to do, I think that whole picture is changing. And so it shifts also our ethical obligations. I usually don't put it in terms of rights necessarily, but I do feel we humans have special obligations to reduce the suffering, especially. I think that's the most important part, to reduce suffering in these animals.
So as we've established, you are not a believer yourself, but can you talk about this? How can people who are happy believing in God, and you're happy to have people continue doing this, how can they still benefit from studying the biological foundations that appear to be part of human morality?
Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily a conflict. Unless you are a biblical literalist, then there's maybe a conflict between, let's say, evolutionary stories and your belief system. But if your belief is more general and more moderate in that sense, is that you look at your religion as basically an inspiration to lead a good life, let's say that's what's true for many people, I believe. That's how they look at their religion. I don't think any biological message about human capacities deriving from primate capacities is necessarily in conflict with the way you look at the world. And that's what I encounter a lot. I encounter a lot of believers who have no big problem with this kind of thinking.
Do you find that there are other atheists who are bothered by your openness to the existence of religion in the world?
Yeah, so actually the book has gotten more criticism from atheists than believers. Even though I come down on the side saying that morality is not produced by religion, it's the neo-atheists that are very upset, because I ask them to stop shouting and to calm down a little, because I believe that the question of why we are on Earth and what to do with our life and why would we want to be moral, those are important questions that are not answered by saying that God exists or doesn't exist. They are answered by people talking among themselves about the origins of morality.
The new book by Franz de Waal is called The Bonobo and the Atheist, In Search of Humanism Among the Primates. Franz, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
You're welcome.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.